Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics. We are joined today not only by our occasional Brock Lesnar-like co-host, Jesse Collings, but also we have a special guest today, John Carlin, who formerly worked with WWE, but has a lot of experience with the WWE Network and with acquiring the library. So we're really excited to talk to John today. How you doing, John?
Hello, all. Doing great. I appreciate it, Brandon, very much. Obviously, you and I have been friendly, I guess, friends. Are we friends? I guess we are. For the better part of the last year or so, I would say, right? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, it sounds about right to me. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm ready to go whenever you guys are, and you hopefully I can help out and bring some great information. And you know, like you said, I mean, I'm there nearly. I was on year 23. Before I left WWE, and I'm ready to go. And whatever you guys got, I'm fire away.
So I guess for the listeners at home or the viewers at home, can you just kind of describe briefly how you came to WWE and what kind of your role was when you were working for the company? Like you said, you had a few different roles over 23 years, but kind of describe briefly what you did while you were working for WWE.
Sure, absolutely. Before WWE, so I was at ESPN at the time in 1998. So I finished, you know, just kind of, I was just a kid, you know, 20 something, and ended up poking around a little bit, you know, looking for jobs. And you know, WWE just happened to be one of them. And at the time, you know, my wife and I, we're not married, so I'm trying very hard to obviously make a good living, and commuting, you know, we lived in Stamford at the time, we were commuting to Bristol in Connecticut, and it was, you know, it was a haul, you know, so it was tough, and it wasn't for a lot of pay, and there wasn't, you know, we didn't have coverage, you know, there was no insurance. So WWE, the headquarters, you know, being in Stamford, as well as the television studio, was right around the corner, directly, more or less across the street from where our apartment was at the time. The pay was better, and the benefits were all there, and it was, you know, kind of a no-brainer. So, you know, and I've always been a wrestling guy. You know, I've always loved the product, grew up on it, as a lot of us did, you know, in the Hogan, the Hogan years, certainly. And, you know, I signed on there in February of 1998. Like you said, obviously a lot of different roles in all of those years. But I think the main thing here, you know, for the audience and for what you guys might be looking for is, you know, the latter stuff. Yes, I did everything as a producer, you know, associate producer, supervising producer, whether it be, you know, I produced some of our syndicated shows for a while. I worked on long form, short form documentaries in the home video department. I did live shoots. I worked on the road for a while, stage managing. That's working with the announce team. I was that dorky dude that sits with the announcers. I was that guy. and also stage manage, which is doing a lot of the backstage stuff with the talent. Certainly went all around the country and all around the world doing shoots with talent and all that kind of stuff. So there's not a lot I haven't done in the business, in the wrestling business and the TV business combined. But like I said, the majority of the stuff that I think is good for the topic here is certainly, the latter years, which was working first for when we first started it, or when WWE first started the SVOD service. That was kind of pre-streaming, pre-Netflix, pre that kind of thing. So that was started back up in 2004, and I kind of was part of the team that headed up that group. And what we did at that time was go out, and I was lucky enough and privileged enough to start acquiring some of these libraries, right? And what we talk about the libraries, and I mean video libraries, all the footage that you see on currently, on the network now, or for some of those documentaries, biographies, whatever you want to call them. Certainly guys had history in other companies. A lot of guys and gals had history, coming up through the business in other companies, certainly. So we at WWE, we wanted to have a lot of that in to be able to provide the viewer, our audience, the WWE universe with the best possible content. We wanted to make sure we got our hands on that. So I was appointed from the production team to kind of be that guy to go out there to go, to Dallas for the World Class Championship Wrestling assessment, to go to Calgary to assess the Stampede Library with the Hart family, that kind of thing, which was great. And like I said, it was a privilege, and the company trusted me, and I would certainly come back, write up a report, give it to the powers that be, and then they would ultimately make the decision for whatever the price was, if it was worth it. So my job was to go there and check things out, whether it be the quality of the actual videotapes themselves, and the actual physical tapes, to the quality of them when they're up. What did they look like? How's the audio? How's the video? And then, of course, to give them a talent assessment. What was the talent like? Do we have A+ talent? Do we just have B talent? Is it worth $1 million that they're charging us for this? Those kinds of things. So I was able to do that again all over the country and in Canada as well. To kind of bring that to the table.
At this stage, we're talking about well before WWE Network. We're talking the WWE Classics on Demand, or WWE 24/7. I feel like they were called both of those things.
They were indeed. You were correct, Jesse.
At the time.
Yep. I was there. I was there for both of those. Yep. We started with 24/7 and evolved into Classics.
Mm-hmm. And so this was kind of, like you said, pre-Netflix, pre-real, traditional, what we would consider now like your standard OTT service. This was an on-demand service. I remember
your Paramount Pluses, all that stuff. None of that stuff existed, obviously, back in 2004.
Right, but on demand and DVR and the ability to watch things on demand, kind of without having to tape something or have TiVo or anything like that, was becoming a kind of a big deal. And WWE was kind of, with a lot of other entertainment companies, looking to see what you can do with this kind of technology, which is what can people watch our product on using their cable subscription when we're not on television. WWE has this video library. So when you first started looking for it, obviously you have WWE's own archives by 2004. Obviously this always going to have that. It's the same company. You would have had WCW. You would have had ECW. Were there other archives that the company already had through various previous purchases? How much of the kind of territorial content library would you say you had before you were kind of started out on this mission, going to Dallas and going to Calgary?
Yeah, like you said, so there was definitely, I'm trying to recall. So ECW, obviously, so with the WCW and the ECW stuff, that was a package deal, right? I didn't have to go on those missions, only because that stuff, again, this is prior, like you said, those acquisitions were prior to this venture, this SVOD venture, but I probably would have been part of it anyway if that was the case. But they obviously, we, you know, WWE bought both of those companies, right? Bought out both of those companies, basically. So the assets came with, you know, so that's definitely, those two would qualify. And WCW was interesting because, you know, there's a lot of history there. So it wasn't just your Nitro Thunder era or your, you know, WCW Saturday Night era. It was all the JCP and for those of you that don't know, Jim Crockett Productions, which was bought out by Turner and turned into WCW. Little history lesson, I guess. But so that stuff went so many years back and came with so many different things, which was fascinating because that came with your Mid-Atlantic. That came with stuff that I actually discovered on the back end of a lot of these reels, which was GCW, Georgia Championship Wrestling, right? So that stuff all came with Jim Crockett Productions. So that was a big history, a big haul of wrestling history, which, you know, was fascinating for guys like me who are into that kind of thing.
It sounds very fascinating because anyone that was a wrestling fan, I'm actually too young to really have done this, but people who are a generation older than me, obviously tape trading or going to yard sales or going to video stores and seeing what people have going through a box of videotapes and being like, oh, look at this. Look what I found. It's, you know, 1986, you know, yep. Jim Crockett promotions, yep. You know, whatever. You're doing that, but on this ridiculously, it sounds like you're doing that, but like on this massive scale where you're going to like the actual whole video libraries and going through this treasure trove of tape trading and tape researching, but you're doing it at like a massive, almost incomprehensible scale to people.
And that's great. You know, it's a thrill. And then getting to let me just finish that other point. So the other one that stands out is the AWA, right? The American Wrestling Association. So, and that, again, for those of you out there that don't know, that was owned by Vern Gagne. And Vern was tough. You know, Vern, I was involved in that, but not as involved as I would become later on. That was a tough haul. I mean, that was, all, you know, a lot of history there, too, because some of that stuff went back to this. We would have miscellaneous reels that went all the way back to, like, WWE had if I remember correctly, I believe we had an old Killer Kowalski match from like 1961 that we found an old AWA taping, like of a television taping from like 1961. If I'm remembering that right, you know, which was, you know, when you're a history guy and you know, you just want to get that kind of stuff on the air, especially if you're doing a piece on Walter, you know, Killer, that kind of stuff. Those are gems. You know, we had a thing called Hidden Gems for a while, and a lot of that stuff, you know, fell into that category. But as you know, these libraries came in, the thing that my job was to try to figure out creative ways, you know, in the team, to be fair, team around me and our group, you know, it was to figure out ways to make these things cool again, right? Or, you know, we're catering to the history fan, to the fan who's looking for this, you know, and there are a lot of them out there because we would hear from them a lot on some of these websites, certainly. How do we put it on the air to make it cool again, make it attractive to all wrestling fans, you know, whether it would be to get a host in and do wraparounds, or whether it be to change the look or to improve something here and there, you know. And there were challenges with that because, you know, one of the main challenges I had on a daily basis, and this morphed into, you know, when we morphed into network use too, you know, it was the copyrighted music is a major, major issue. Okay. That costs the company a lot of money if those things slip through the cracks. And one of my main jobs, you know, for our group, and then later it became company-wide. I was kind of the go-to guy company-wide for any issues, or, you know, I kind of became a liaison between production and legal. So I was on the phone constantly with the lawyer, with the music lawyers as well as the regular lawyers, you know, because there were other issues with likenesses or folks, or when you bought some of these libraries, you know, back then there were handshake agreements with these old promoters. You know, the handshake agreement in the 2000s and the 2020s, you know, that's not okay. You know, for a billion-dollar company like WWE, you know, we got to play by the rules. You know, things have to be right, or else we end up, WWE again ends up losing on the losing side financially. And that's, you know, that was kind of my, I was kind of the watchdog for that. Again, another important role that I embraced and obviously was very proud of. You know, so that was a big deal. You know, I had, you know, and again, now I became the guy the entire company looked to for this kind of stuff. You know, so I had spreadsheet after spreadsheet after spreadsheet with, you know, I would, the team, I don't want to take anything away from the team. They were certainly involved up to their necks in this as well. But just, you know, having a hand in picking out all the brand new music and then figuring out creative ways to get it into the program. And I'm talking about music that was either in an open, in a package, in a package as a feature, right? Or, you know, the closing portion of the program, ring entrances, right? That's a big deal. Those were big. So a lot of times you'd run into some of these older companies that would just roll out whatever the hit was of the day to their biggest star. You know, in the mid South area, for instance, Junkyard Dog, you know, used to come down to, a popular Queen, hit, right? Another One Bites the Dust, right? And they didn't care because it fit JYD and that's what they went with and it was popular and so be it, you know, but we had to address that kind of thing, you know, so that was either rebuilding the entire entrance with a new piece of music, trying to save the announce if possible. Sometimes we got lucky, you know, with the ECW library, for instance. You know, Joey Styles, the main play-by-play guy there, for as most of you know, they always had a clean channel. And what I mean by that is on one of the channels, channel one used to be just Joey, no crowd, no music. That saved our behinds on numerous occasions because ECW was the biggest violator of this, no matter what, because you know how Paul Heyman operated, and that was the end of the lot. Whatever, he didn't care. You know, that's how they got their freaking reputation in the first place. So that, luckily, you know, we got hundreds of hours of ECW shows on the air that we probably would not have been able to, or would have struggled for hours upon hours trying to figure out how to make that happen and make it presentable. You know, that's the key. We always had to make stuff presentable. We're not going to put a product on the air that's halfway done, right? That's not how we
operate. It has no audio.
Right. Has no, or it's choppy, or, you know, some of the times we had to if we couldn't lose the music and we didn't have a clean track of the play-by-play guys, WCW had some of that too frequently. So that was also helpful. We would just take the new piece of music and what we would call bury the old music. So again, we did a lot of the editing on our own, and that was another great part of being at WWE. You got so much experience as not only a producer, but an editor as well. But some of the stuff was just too complicated. That's why we actually had real editors, that was what they were paid for. So we would take harder projects to them and just do the best you could, you know. So we would have to bury the old music, so we'd lower that, you know, to a point, and then maybe dump a little bit of new crowd on top so the crowd still kind of existed. You know, we're trying to keep it as authentic as possible. But, you know, and then slide a little bit of the announcers up and down here and there, maybe for some just important parts of, you know, introducing the character or making the announcement of who he or she would be facing. Whatever we thought was as important, you know, important enough to get on the air to help the product obviously not lose its integrity, you know, was important. So we try to slide maybe the announce up just a little bit and get little quips in there with hearing maybe the littlest amount of the quote real music as possible. So we would try, we obviously put in the effort to not have any of that music ever be on the air. Some with, like I said, a beat or two here and there slid in there just to get the announcer to say a line that we needed. You know, we did the best we could to get rid of it. But those were tricky, and that was the most difficult of that. And again, that same thing happened when we morphed to the network. You know, and sometimes it even got more complicated, because then, you know, we had to deal with, you know, starting, like you said, the old all the WWE libraries, right? We had to go back and start from Raw number one, you know, back in 1994 or 1995. You know, that was where we started. And a lot of times the standards and practices back then weren't necessarily what they are today. You know, so those had to be all the Raws, all the SmackDowns,
I was going to ask, were you involved in the scrubbing of the WWF logo?
Oh, was I ever, Jesse? another horrible part of what we did there. But at the end of the day, enjoyable. Yes, of course. That was right smack dab in the middle of classics. So we would spend hours removing, you know, whether it be, you know, obviously audio wise, you know, you couldn't say those three letters, right?
WWE.
Exactly. We either took the whole thing out, or you got what you know, most of the time we got, and people hated it, but there was nothing. I mean, our group was basically the group that did that. Yes, we were the ones who did all of that. And then, you know, you had to get the turnbuckles, right? You had to put her the turnbuckles.
Yeah, that was a bad, in hindsight, horrible. You probably wish you didn't put the logo on the turnbuckles.
No, and then there was various, you know, the rules at WWE changed all the time. For those of you that don't know that. It's just a quirk, and it's just the way that the company operates. So, you know, there was a time where it was just the scratch logo, so we were good. You know, so the block logo, the old WWF, the block one, that one was okay. And then a year later, it wasn't okay. So we had to go all the way back and retrack our steps and to pull all that stuff down and redo all of that. You know, whether it be the referee's jersey or the you know, sometimes the logo would be on the ring mat, right? Or certainly on the skirts, right? The ring skirts were a major deal. Certainly up in the rafters, sometimes they would have them hanging all over the place, you know, back in the, you know, in the 90s, certainly.
So you're doing like a Where's Waldo, where you're looking at still shots and being like, oh, there's a logo. It's up there. It's in the top left corner. It's hanging from the rafters.
100%. No joke. 100%. You hit it right on the head. And that took up hours and hours and hours of our time. For sure, and just to blur one of those. At one point, we just gathered, like, you know, a dozen episodes at a time. Let's just say, and I'm just making that number up, whatever it was, and you know, we would have folks, PAs, you know, go through them and make sure they wrote down every single time the logo came, you know, make logs of those things. And just because it was taking up so much of our edit time that we had to actually do to get stuff on the air, we just gave it to editors, like, on the side, like either overnight or, you know, at a time where we would just have them come in and work with us for 10 hours, but not in the edit, just by themselves in some room somewhere else, just doing blurring. Blurring was a full-time job. The edit staff had folks that were just there to blur. You know, that's how big of a project that was, for sure.
You talked about copyright and worrying about that aspect when it comes to editing. When the transition from WWE Network to Peacock took place, there were a lot of stories about having to go back and look at content and say, is this content appropriate for a major streaming service like Peacock? Are we going to have, there's a lot of stuff that happened in wrestling history, especially if you go to some of these older territories, that would not be considered politically correct today. Wouldn't be politically correct back then, but 100%. It was wrestling and it was considered lowbrow. Was that something at all that was discussed either with, you know, Classics on Demand or Network, as far as keep an eye out for certain things that we can't have, you know, whether it's on our on-demand streaming service or on our network?
Certainly, and I don't want to lie to you or to the folks out there. The Peacock's switch, the switch over to Peacock happened after my time, so I can't really speak to that directly. But what you said is basically true. Yes, I mean, because we went through that. My experience with that, because I do have some, is At the beginning, there was a lot of, so we had two sides to the network, and I think it still operates that way now. I'm not sure. There was the linear side and the VOD side, right? So I was basically captain of the VOD side. So on the VOD side, we could basically air whatever we wanted as long as we rated it appropriately. So if the show was really, really, really bad, and I'm talking about politically incorrect, a bloody massacre, sexuality, hell, nudity, whatever happened, those kinds of things. You know, if we had to rate the show, you know, the worst possible rating that we had, that was okay for VOD. Anything goes on VOD. That was our direction. That's what we were told, and that was still the standard as far as, you know, as far as I know. But there was a lot of debate at the early rollout in 14, 15, around that time. There was debate about the linear side. So at the beginning, the linear side followed kind of the same rules, which was, in retrospect, a huge mistake. I mean, I think all of us that were...
Real quick, can you just clarify what do you mean when you say linear side as opposed to VOD side?
Sure. So the VOD side, you have to have like... It's a parental thing. You know, you have to have parental permission, or there's codes that you have to put in, or some sort of a thing that like kids can't get to it unless their parents mm-hmm. know about it, something along those lines. The linear side was more of like your everyday TV, like you and I just going into the living room, putting the TV on, you know, and flipping channels, you know, that. So like they had a lineup and everything, like where, like you said, in today's day and age, we like the streaming stuff. We like to stop and go. We like to put on whatever we want. We want to choose this episode or that episode. Nobody wants to like hang out and watch, you know, whatever you have scheduled for me on your television network from 9 to 5. That's just not a thing. But they wanted it to be that way on one side. So that's the way the linear side was set up. They had a schedule. There was a schedule for every day, what was airing. You know, it was just like an old school TV network.
If people remember, this would be like if you went on WWE Network on their app, and you would just see they'd be always be playing something at certain times. If it was a pay-per-view on, it would be a pay-per-view. Yep. But sometimes you just turn it on, they'd be showing, you know, original content or old Raws or things like that.
Exactly. So the debate, like I said, 2014, 2015, maybe 16, I don't know how long it lasted. But the problem was to have no rules on the linear side and just let that go. Like they were letting go, and all of us on the other side, to be fair, we knew that was, you know, probably not such a great idea, because anybody has access to it, you know, and to see some of that stuff, you know, the rumors that we heard were folks over at the tower. And for those of you that don't know how WWE is set up, there's Titan Tower, right, which is the main corporate building, which y'all can see off the exit if you travel on 95 South in Connecticut. And then there's a television studio, which is around the corner. So we worked around the corner in the television studio. So apparently, again, from what we heard, there was folks who were going up in the elevators daily at Titan Tower, high executives, and even, you know, certainly some females, and saw some things on there that were very inappropriate and very not okay for linear. And I guess a lot of people in the hierarchy were hearing about it pretty much regularly, and that changed right quick. So, which was for the best. It was for the best for the company. It was for the best for the network.
Because in the elevator at Titan Tower, right, there's a monitor with W Network playing on it.
Correct. 24/7. So that's how
it's WWE executives being surprised.
I think it, not necessarily executive. I think it was any employees that maybe mm-hmm. felt it uncomfortable or felt like, wow, I'm not sure if we should be watching this at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, whatever it might have been, you know. So, and again, that's rumor. That's what we were told or what we heard. So then, you know, that's when linear became, to your point about the Peacock situation, linear became a very, very strict. In other words, people would come to me a lot. This was another one of my many hats that I wore. It was and there were lots of them. So it was, folks would come to me through a colleague of mine who I worked closely with, who helped me a great deal in my VOD ventures there. They would often go to her and try to pitch these ideas that she then in turn had to come to me. And I had to basically say, yes, that's okay for linear. No, hell no, that's not okay for linear. That was, you know, and one in particular that I always use it as an example, because I just can't understand it, because it happened year after year after year. Because a lot of times on the linear side, that folks wanted to use content that was relevant to a holiday, for instance, right? A Black History Month, right? Something like that. So every year, I would constantly get asked the question, can we air St. Valentine's Day Massacre on the linear side? And every year, the answer was continuously, not a chance in hell, right? Because it's not appropriate for PG. It's not, linear was strictly at this point, PG only, PG only, PG only. So the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, for those of you that don't know, was a old February pay-per-view back in 1999 that had, you know, blood and guts and sexuality all over the place. It was like from hour one to hour three. So like that was never going to see the light of day under my watch. So that was, you know, those were some of the things to try and give you something. Again, since I wasn't there for the Peacock switchover, it was a very similar situation. I know exactly what you're talking about, how strict, you know, they can be. And that same thing happened that I can speak to. Again, another thing I just happened to think of, that same thing happened with our, you know, when we were doing the shows, the best of shows, if any of you remember those were the things that we were kind of doing when the pandemic first hit, when we were all sent home, because we really were struggling for content. Those shows then in turn would get cut down and sent over to Fox, because FS1 obviously had no programming either, with all sports, you know, shut down. So that was another project that was very, so their S&P group, and that what I mean by that is standards and practices, were even stricter than anything that we had to go through me or through any folks to get stuff on our linear side. They had an even stricter group over there that they went through. And even though we had made it fully PG safe, that wasn't fully PG safe sometimes in their view. So they would go through and pick apart stuff. Like I remember one time, I think I got a list. I thought I was fully done with the program. It was Best of Ric Flair, as a matter of fact. And I thought it was done, shipped, ready to go. And like, I think the next morning I got a list of about 30 or 40 fixes that they had that like I would never have seen in a million years, you know, unless you scrub the thing with a fine tooth comb, which is what they were doing, you know, which was a hassle, but it was what we had to do with our partners and make people, you know, everybody happy and get the product on the air that they wanted. So that's what we did. So, but in, you know, that's just another example.
I feel like a Best of Ric Flair that's PG maybe just contains his entrance and that's it.
Right.
Well, like
right.
You said, like St. Valentine's Day Massacre is like kind of like a classic Attitude Era pay-per-view. Exactly. I'm assuming most of the Attitude Era content, which is, I'm assuming, by far the most popular retro content that was on the network. And it's certainly the most popular retro content in the podcasting world. Wasn't on the linear side because basically all of it wouldn't have passed the test for being PG.
Zero. Mm-hmm. Yep. Not a chance. None of it. But again, like, you know, we use our VOD, you know, we filled the VOD side with like everything that's on VOD right now or certainly a large chunk of it was done by myself and my team, you know, which, you know, at this stage of the game, all the ups and downs that have gone on with the pandemic and, you know, certain layoffs and different things of that nature is basically doesn't exist anymore. The whole team of us are unfortunately, I think, gone. But you know, 90%+ of that content was done by our group. You know, the entire ECW library, the entire WCCW library, the entire Mid-South Library, et cetera. All of that stuff was done by our group, and we're, you know, certainly proud of that, and took a lot of work and a lot of hours. And, you know, I just hope it was something that the fans today can still enjoy.
Can you talk about being in WWE during that time period and kind of, my question is kind of like a timeline of enthusiasm from the company side when it comes to the network, because it seemed like from the outside looking in that enthusiasm for the network kind of waxed and waned throughout its existence. There were periods of time where it felt like a lot of resources were being pumped into the network and there was going to be a lot of different content that was going to be developed. But then 6 months later, they'd be canceling stuff and programs that were supposed to happen or programs that did happen are gone. Can you kind of describe what do you feel like as an employee, like what the enthusiasm internally was for the network? And you felt like if you had a consistent support for the network and the idea of the network throughout its entire existence.
And I guess we could add, there were a lot of different leadership changes throughout the early couple of years of the network, right?
And still, you know, and still are. I mean, certainly that happened throughout the last couple of years as well. You know, and we were certainly part of that, you know. I think you described it pretty accurately, you know, to be honest. It definitely waned. There was definitely, you know, certainly a period of time where everybody was all in, right? And like you said, and then, you know, 6 months later, it was, you know, most everybody was all out, you know, and we had to kind of struggle to stay relevant. You know, at one point, you know, the VOD service was the main focus of everybody in the company. You know, the goal was 10,000 hours of programming. And I must have heard that line a zillion and a half times, you know, because I would have to go there and present, you know, monthly to executives and other folks, you know, just what the progress was. I mean, I think they wanted 10,000 hours in something like 5 years, and we were pumping out so much content, we were able to get it done in three. You know, again, another proud moment that certainly that I still hold very close, and I thank the team, of course, for sure. But you know, after that point, you know, and that took a lot. You know, at one point we were doing over 250 hours of programming per month. You know, that's a lot. I mean, we had, you know, I think at our height we had 10 folks, I think, all together, maybe 10 or 11, whatever it was. But still, you know, folks are also doing other things, you know, so that's a lot, you know, and I had to work right alongside them. You know, I wasn't just assigning stuff. I was working right alongside them. But to your point, you know, the VOD stuff, after that goal was hit, we were lost in the shuffle, to be quite frank. I had to struggle to, you know, continuously try to, you know, stress the importance of all this. I mean, we spent millions of dollars on all this footage. You know, we should still continue to get it up. We should continue to use it. Fans still enjoy it. You know, we certainly, if we slowed or we didn't get a good haul out for the month, whatever it might have been, you know, we certainly heard about it. Yeah, was it a niche group of fans for the most part? But we knew there was plenty of fans out there that enjoyed it and that wanted it. And you know, not to give it to them, you know, when we became, like I said, less and less relevant, you know, I obviously being the guy who was kind of heading up that group, that didn't make me very happy, you know, but that, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, certainly, and that's not just with this, you know, I think that certainly happened throughout my career there and happened with many different ventures. That's just kind of how WWE is. That's just kind of how it goes there. You know, it happened, you know, the more it happened, you know, the more you kind of got used to it. And it just, you know, you knew it was coming. It was just a matter of time, you know, whenever it was. And sometimes that's, you know, that's okay. Sometimes that's, you know, just rolling with the times and rolling with what's hot. And I understand that, you know, so that, you know, to their point, you know, that's, I can understand that, you know, in that particular, if you think of it that way, sure. But you know, certainly that's the way it works within the company where, you know, it's in and out, you know, full bore one day, not so much the next day. That's just the way it rolls.
Do you Do you think their goals changed in the sense that maybe when the network first started, the idea, like you said, VOD was so important and you had these, you know, kind of ambitious goals set up for how much content we're going to have available to people who are subscribing. And then as the network continued to go on and as the product continued to go, I feel like it became more, at least from a company perspective, more obvious that the things that were driving people to the network were going to be the current product. We're going to be live events, going to be pay-per-views, going to be WrestleMania. Do you feel like the VOD was kind of put on the wayside, or at least rendered a secondary goal because, or a third goal because, as the network kind of matured, it became kind of clear, at least to executives, that the goal, that the actual driving revenue of the network is always going to be our current product and not all of this stuff in the past.
I would think, yeah, for sure. I think that there are certainly some folks there. A lot of those folks, again, like I said, are pretty much all gone now. So I'm not disparaging anybody or throwing anybody under the bus. It's just there were some people there that I don't think understood as much about, you know, which again, to somebody like myself and others who were like me, who know the importance of the history of this business and you know, give our blood, sweat, and tears for it and, you know, embrace it and know how important that was to where we are today, to have that kind of poo-pooed from folks that I feel like, regardless whether they were in positions of power or not, that I felt like, you know, maybe not all of them understood the business, you know, and maybe didn't know anything before 1990-ish, you know, something like that, and, you know, that we're calling some of the shots. So I think that certainly had a part in it. You know, just to give you an example, like I said, we were 250 plus hours per month at our peak. When I was let go, I think we were barely holding on to 20 hours per month for VOD. So that's kind of where it ended up, even though it's, you know, we have a giant platform there that, you know, that we dump hundreds and thousands of hours into. There's still that much left in the tank in the library, you know, to be honest. So yeah, I think that's certainly the case. You know, certainly it was more, and then they started doing more of those types of things with the current talent. You know, like your ride-alongs and your table for three and, you know, those kinds of things, the bump, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, was, you know, they incorporated more of the current talent and emphasized that for sure. So, yeah, I think you hit it on the head on that one.
Were you involved in any of the acquisitions involving like current existing independent wrestling talent? We know that, you know, they had Evolve Programming. They had, I think, West Side, yep, Extreme Wrestling in Germany from there. I want to say Progress was also involved. Were you involved in any of that?
And ICW, Insane Championship Wrestling. Yep. I was the guy. I was the point guy for it. Yep.
Talk to me about that, because I'm really interested in knowing, like, were you surprised? Were you given a directive to open negotiations with these people? Like, that was kind of a very atypical move by WWE to kind of work with active groups to essentially promote their business.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it was an opportunity. I think it was a win-win. That's how I looked at it, because it was a win for us because we gained more programming, probably for a discounted price. And, you know, we didn't have to buy the library. You know, it was just in some sort of contract. And again, that wasn't something that I negotiated. That was not me. Mm-hmm. I'm just a TV guy. You know, I don't negotiate contracts. But yeah, that was another hat that I wore, was the independent wrestling promotion guy. You know, basically anything that went near or touched VOD, I had to be involved with it in some way, shape, or form. So, like I said, a win-win was we got the discount, we got the footage, and then these folks who were struggling to find a wide platform for their product, holy cow, they get to be on WWE Network now. I mean, it took us some years to actually get it up, you know, because there was different levels that they wanted to make, different levels of the network and make it a different tier. So they went through many different, a couple of years worth of how these tiers were going to look and where the indie product was going to go, and that was going to be, you know, X amount more dollars per month, you know, if you wanted that and those kinds of things. So it just took a lot to get it up, because I worked with it pretty much from the time we started in business with these folks, which was probably, I want to say 17, maybe 18, something like that. You know, so
I was listening to a talk from George Berrios, who was probably the co-president at the time. And yep. He just sort of brought up, just without prompting, oh, yeah, we have deals with Progress and ICW.
I remember that. Yeah,
2017.
Yeah.
That was really surprising to me.
Yeah, listening. I remember that. Yeah, I remember that happening. Yeah. But yeah, so we'll call it 2017. So, you know, and then when I let, you know, again, when I was let go in 2020. And at that time, again, I worked on those shows. That was exclusively me. Like, I was the only one that worked on those shows, unless they got overwhelming and there was too many. I would have some help, but those were basically just all me. So they would send in, I don't know, half dozen or so, six or eight, 10 maybe at a time, of their weekly show, as well as some of their, as well as all of their pay-per-views. You know, like, you hit them all in the head. You know, Evolve, ICW, Insane Championship Wrestling, which is over in the UK, Progress,
Scotland,
Scotland, Progress also in the UK. That's more of an English brand, and then WXW, which was the German folks that you mentioned, which is kind of where today's, you know, I guess Gunther, he's called nowadays, was kind of a big star over there.
Yeah, June 2017 looks like the timing for that comment from Berrios. Yeah, just to update everybody there.
I knew we kept that dude around here for a reason, but nonetheless, all of those. I probably did hundreds of those shows, and like I said, when I was let go, they still hadn't made air yet. I don't believe. I think they might have been just starting. Where they might have started when the pandemic hit, because we figured, what the hell, we need programming. Why don't we just use it now? You know, and again, a lot of that stuff, most of that stuff was, I had to check through every show that came in. So again, similar to the other shows, but not as bad, because we were obviously living in the late 2000s. Go through all the music, right? Go through all the music. What was the music? Where did it come from? Some of them had their own they had their own composers and stuff. So that was fishy. You had to kind of like look into that all from a legal standpoint. Every now and then they try to roll out a real piece. They try to slide one through, you know, obviously that we had to put a stop to, those kinds of things. But all those shows, their audio was always all over the place. So that was tricky. You know, we had to deal with that a lot. And by that, I mean, it was either way too freaking low or way, way too high. So I would do that. You know, those are pretty much weekly, every other week or so, maybe. So I did, all of those four libraries for sure. Everything that they sent to our company went through me. And I got to know a lot of that. I really studied those guys, and I got to know a lot of it. So that's why when I see them nowadays, you know, I'm like, man, you know, back then I was probably the only one that ever knew who that dude actually was, you know, or whatever.
Were you?
And that kind of helped out the UK. You know, had that spinoff for the UK NXT
right? UK,
right? So that was similar to a lot of those guys work there now. You know, so.
Were you given like a directive, like when the indie company content started coming in, were you told like, we're doing this this will be good additions to our video library. We'll have, you know, matches of guys who are on our show now, obviously NXT UK guys, a lot of them start, you know, we're in Progress and other European promotions. Were you given kind of a directive? Like, this is why you're suddenly now doing all of this work with all these, independent companies and these European companies?
Not necessarily. I don't remember that being a thing. I think it was just like providing us with more footage and providing them a bigger platform so they could get exposure. And I mean, obviously I think there was a point where we probably saw a future for us to use it in some capacity, and probably wanted to have like an inside track on deals with talent that they felt were worthwhile to come over. Obviously, I think that's got to be an assumption, but I was never told that or given that directive. No. Yeah. So the ICW was Fight Club, and then Progress. I pulled
up the network on.
Yeah, I don't know if Progress had a name. I don't remember that.
This is Peacock, you mean? Not this the is network.
The Peacock. Yes. Peacock. Well, the network on Peacock. Yes. Yeah. I was wondering if I could ask you about some of the, I guess, the more prominent wrestling libraries.
Oh, you know what Progress was? Progress was chapters.
That's right.
So it was like Progress Chapter 115, Progress Chapter 116. That's how they did their business. Those are the everyday show or the weekly shows, whatever they were.
Yeah. I would like to get into some of the libraries that are pretty prominent to me in wrestling history, especially the territory era,
sure.
But are not so much – they're certainly not on the network. And one of them that comes to mind is I think you said that this was wrapped up in the Jim Crocker Promotions acquisition. So like Georgia, there's no Georgia Championship Wrestling on the network, as far as I know.
Yep.
So what do you think the story is with that, or do you know why is none of that content out there?
I can tell you 100%. So what's tricky with Georgia was we weren't able to. The original take, and again, this could be wrestling folklore for all I know, but the original Georgia Championship Wrestling, the original assets, we never were able to get our hands on for whatever reason. What we heard was, once again, take this with a grain of salt, what we heard was that Ole Anderson, who was the promoter at the time, before they were kind of bought out by Crockett, I believe is the way it went down, was so crazed and so angry that these were going to be purchased and then somehow into our hands at some point, because he was a big anti-Vince, anti-WWE guy. He still never did business with us at all, like even when we did the Horseman stuff, even when we did, Flair stuff that we really needed him for, didn't really. I mean, screw him. If he didn't want to do it, he didn't want to do it. But, like, he still held that grudge to this day.
Yeah.
But what we had heard was he took all the original Georgia Championship Wrestling tapes, took them around back of an empty arena, and set them on fire. That's the story that we got. And, again, you can take that with a grain of salt and do it with what you will. But the point is that the Georgia footage that we ended up getting – and I mentioned this a little bit earlier that I was able to find, or one of us was able to find, on the back end of some of these old, like, I don't think it was the Mid-Atlantic reels. It was, although it might have been, or it was old, the old WCW shows prior to Saturday Night. They were on the back of all of those. All of these reels, like weird out of nowhere, but they were clearly recorded off of a DVD, right? You could see the DVD start, and then you could see it finish, right? You knew that's what happened. And a lot of times the footage was garbage, unairable, just so poor that you would do yourself a disservice. I would do the fans a disservice if I wanted to air it, and I would certainly, I would get fired, because it just, so that's your answer for Georgia. Georgia just, there's not a lot of it. I think we have you would probably have enough episodes if you wanted to run a few in a consecutive, but they're so hit and miss, and the footage is so poor and the audio is so poor that it's hard. We've used it in the past. I don't think we've ever aired an episode. I think we've used it. I know I have for B-roll, and for those of you that don't know B-roll, that's just like miscellaneous shots over, like if somebody's speaking or whatever that might be. And that, I definitely used it on that because I can see a Tony Atlas shot from Georgia that I definitely used in an old Legends of Wrestling show. So that's your answer for Georgia. The other one that I would fit in that category that I was part of purchasing certainly is CWF, the old Florida stuff.
Florida, yep.
So we did that, and that was a twofold situation because that was dual owned. So one chunk of the library was owned by the Grahams. Eddie Graham was the original promoter down there. Mike Graham was in charge when we were there. And then there was another later chunk of the library that was taken over by Steve Kern. So Steve Kern worked
like later in time, like
later in time. So Mike had all the really, really good stuff, you know, for guys like me who just would like sit back and watch for hours, right? It was all the stuff, you know, the 1970s Dusty, you know, all the stuff that was.
And this is Gordon Solley.
Gordon doing the hosting, like standing up and pitching the stuff and, you know, all of that stuff. So, and Kearns ended up being like 80s and 90s, you know, late. Okay. Not that it wasn't quality stuff. It was. It just didn't have the allure that the Graham stuff had. That stuff, I always tried to figure out how to get it aired because it was so good. They came in pieces, for lack of a better term. They weren't well put together, like we just said. There was a lot of Gordon and just like pitching his stuff, and then he would go in a different direction, and it was you know, footage from another spot or another time. And again, sometimes there was those handshake agreements where we'd have to pull footage out because we didn't have rights to it. But those were such good quality. They just didn't have a good cohesive versions of the shows, which I thought was a shame because we were able to put together a nice series of them for classics. But that's because we used Mike Graham as a host. And that's what we did with a lot of that stuff, which is a point that I wanted to bring up earlier. We did with a lot of that stuff on classics is, you know, we used guys or gals who were relevant, you know, and that was my thing, which I thought was most important to the audience, was we used people who were relevant to the product. You know, I never, ever in my life wanted to use Michael Cole to host a History of ECW show. Like, I was never going to do that, ever, because that was just not something I could bring myself to do. Nothing against Michael. I like Michael. We've always been friends. But Taz was a no-brainer, right? Because here you got a guy who lived it. Who better would I want to host a show than somebody who lived it? So that's why we used him for that. We used Mike Graham for the CWF shows. We used Michael Hayes and Kevin Von Erich for the WCCW stuff. You know, that was, we used Gene for Hall of Fame because who better to host Hall of Fame than Mean Gene? You know, so those were kind of things that we did to try to make the product as great quality as we could. Sorry, I got off on a completely different tangent there, but yeah, the CWF is unfortunate. I wish we could have found a better way. The only other one is Stampede. Stampede was always tricky.
And some of it appeared on the network for a time, and then it suddenly disappeared.
Yeah, because it became a Brett issue. It's always kind of a Brett issue. So usually Brett has some sort of legal say in the stuff. So sometimes WWE thinks that they got everything square with Brett, and then it's not square with Brett. So that's why that stuff happens with Sam.
And the issue is that he owns the rights to his own matches.
Correct. And I don't know why we wouldn't air other ones. I don't know why that never became a thing because I was in charge of programming most of the time.
Did you know like how he got rights to that, or was the Stampede library sold to WWE but not the Brett matches? Is that how it worked?
I think that's how it worked. Yeah. I mean, because I certainly was there for Stampede too. I mean, I was there with that purchase. I met with his brothers. So there was Ross and Bruce. They were the guys who were running the library purchase.
And so would that have been before the Brett DVD came out? I think in like 2005 or something. I can imagine him being more protective and afraid.
Thank you for bringing that up, Brandon. So that's exactly correct. So when it was time for the Brett DVD, then we had to get into a negotiation with Brett. That's how that went down. So then he signed off on rights for X amount of footage or footage for that, I guess. And then somehow, I think we thought it meant somehow there was confusion that maybe he signed off on all of it, and that's why some of it started to air, and then that was not the case. Again, I'm picking at details that I don't know exactly the facts. That's just what we heard and what were kind of the rumors were. But there's plenty of, you know, there's other shows out there. You know, certainly I did a run of them on Classics. You know, there's plenty of them on Classics, or were on Classics. You know, so it's you got me thinking now because I'm not sure why I never went back to that. I think people just thought because of that situation that Stampede became such a headache that nobody wanted to deal with approving it. So it just kind of got left behind, I think. That's because I loved I was a big fan of their library. So I why there had to be a reason why I didn't at least pitch it a couple of times, because I used to do the schedule, the entire 12-month schedule for the network for everything VOD. So everything that came out every month, I was the one that was scheduling that. I would schedule them years, and every August I would go and schedule the next full 12 months and get it approved. So somebody must have along the way said, hey, you know, can we stay away from the Stampede stuff? That must have happened at some point. I just can't remember that when that was, and I probably just never revisited it for whatever reason.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You talked about this before. You're no longer with the company, and you're talking about kind of some what I would consider almost like lost stuff at this point. Like, you know, the Stampede stuff exists, but it's not on there. You know, some of the Florida stuff exists, but it's not on there. Do you have any optimism that we will see any of this stuff ever uploaded? It seems like the philosophy behind what they're interested in putting on their streaming services has changed, but do you have any idea, like, on thinking that eventually fans will be able to see some of this stuff?
I don't want to paint the picture the wrong way. Like, there wasn't like anybody saying that CWF couldn't air, or anybody said that, you know, the again, there was some Brett stuff, but I don't think there was anything necessarily blocking that stuff from airing. It's difficult to put it together to air, I guess, is the answer. So no, I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying, most of the time it was more of a difficulty putting it together than there was anybody saying that they wanted to go in a different direction or were preventing us from putting anything up. You know, that wasn't necessarily the case at all. I don't want to make that clear. Do I have hope? I don't know. You know, at this stage of the game, and from what I do know, because there is a former colleague of mine and a close friend that is still there that has that stuff kind of ended up in his lap. And from the last time I spoke with him, a couple of months back about that kind of thing, he said it was still a thing. It was still going, but it's basically an afterthought at this point, you know? So he just kind of does it, puts it up, and kind of nobody says anything.
Since the Peacock era, I don't think so. Almost everything has made it over to Peacock for US viewers, but I don't think they've added anything. I know there's some WF Superstars episodes, I believe, that have been added, but as far as like older territorial stuff that's part of libraries that were acquired, I don't think any of that has been
added. It's very small. But to be fair, you know, a lot of the stuff, like I think I mentioned earlier, you know, that a lot of those territorial libraries are, you know, for the most part, complete. Like, World Class is complete. You know, Mid-South proper is complete. You know, there's another Mid-South show that I think of it off the top of my head. There was another weekly Mid-South show that we didn't bother going down that road because it was too legally difficult to get around because the music was too much and we just couldn't get it out. So But and let me clarify. So the Mid-South Library, from what we acquired, what WWE acquired, like, are there missing episodes? Absolutely, there's missing episodes. But that wasn't our fault. We put up every episode that was given to us in the purchase from the Watts family. You know, whatever they gave us, we put up. World Class is the same. Some of the episodes were damaged. Some of the episodes are missing, 100%. But like the weekly WCCW show, all of those episodes that are owned by WWE are on the air. There's nothing that was left behind. That library, in our view, what I used to, another thing that people were really interested in at that time was, okay, well, give me the news when the library's complete. That's what we want to hear now. We want to hear this library's complete, this library's complete, this library's complete. So that was kind of my thing for a while, for a good running year or so, was make sure we tell everybody when we complete the libraries. So in our view, like I said, and there's more, you know, ECW is complete. Certainly WCW is not, because there's so many facets of it. But like Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, that's complete. I'm trying to think of what else. Let me see. I got some notes here.
There's a little bit of Smoky Mountain on there.
Yep. Trying to think. But those are complete. Those libraries are complete in ours. Smoky Mountain was I'll get to that in a second. You know, and I say that because, and a lot of times, you know, sometimes, like you were saying earlier, I think, about the tape exchanges back in the day, right? Old school style. Mm-hmm. That was done often. You know, if we thought something was really important and we didn't have access to it, there was, you know, guys on our staff that were very, very good at that kind of thing that would go out there.
You're saying if you didn't have the master of a given episode.
True. And we thought it was important enough. Now, we didn't do it on every episode because that would be a waste of money. So we did it on episodes or certain instances that we thought were super, super important. And we thought we have to have this as part of this package or this library or this, the story that we're telling here. We certainly had access or knew how to get access to folks online that would have said masters. And then we did it kind of on, you know, it was a kayfabe situation. We certainly didn't tell them we were WWE knocking on their door. You know, we just told them we were miscellaneous, like whoever was doing it was doing it. And you know, we did that a million times. I mean, you know, all those old East, which now are also complete, the ECW super shows, you know, which I had a part of. That was kind of one of the last things I think I was hit, you know, very involved in. Those were all purchased online. We had none of, Paul never gave us any of those. So those were all online purchases and redone. You know, so those are tricky too, because you don't have any audio to mess around with. You have to figure it all out, you know, because it's kind of a complete master. It's not. Yeah. Stuff that we can work, you know, it was difficult to work with. Let's put it that way.
And what do you do if there's a New Jack match where they're playing Natural Born Killers through the whole match? Disaster. As he's throwing.
I wish I had my editor friend on this call. He could tell you a story or two about that, because him and I worked deep into nights doing New Jack matches, just New Jack matches only. I kid you not. And you laugh, but. I'm telling you, Brandon, it wasn't funny. It was painful, but absolutely. So what we had to do was, and we got it down after a while, you know, after you did five of them, you know, you didn't have to worry about it as much anymore. You know, we would have to go through, we picked out a new, you know, I picked out a new piece of music, which was one of my all time favorites. And every single thing, you know, that was, again, that was one of those lucky occasions, for the most part, that we had Joey Styles on a clean channel. So we had the commentary. If you have the commentary, the rest is basically cake except for New Jack. So when we got into those matches, you would have to, you know, we knew we had Joey, so we were good. But you had to take, you know, we ended up just combing through his sound effects machine. You know, all our audio editors, right, have sound effect. They have thousands of sound effects, right, that we could choose from. So we would find one and we would label it toaster, and we would find one and labeled it keyboard, you know, and we'd find one and label it broomstick, you know, we would find one and we would label it computer monitor, you know, or, you know, whatever, you know, toaster oven, you know, whatever, mop, you know, can, you know, whatever. And then we would just use those all throughout and rebuilding those matches. No lie, just those matches alone would take longer than it would take us to rebuild the entire pay-per-view. You know, it was that wow. difficult, and it was an adventure. But you know, every one of those New Jack matches is on there. You know, we never lost any of them, which is again something I'm real proud of. You know, we tried to keep the integrity as best we could. So those were certain. I'm really glad you brought that up, because that was a memory that I hadn't thought of in a while.
So speaking of editing, anyone that ever had WWE Network knows that if they were to type in Benoit in the search bar, nothing would come up.
Right.
What was it like dealing with that kind of content? Because to my knowledge, I can't think of any like Chris Benoit matches not existing on the network. But it does seem like, obviously, there was a directive to not promote him in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
In any way on the network. You know, I'm sure he's not in any thumbnails. I'm sure he's not in any like match listings. He's 100%. The content is there, but you have to find it yourself. Yep. Did that require specific editing on your end? And I'm also curious to know if there's anybody else who was given that directive, or is it an issue solely related to Chris Benoit?
So yes, certainly that was a major directive, especially pre-network. So pre-network, for classics, he was a no-go. He was a no-go. Matches were removed. There was no mentions of him were removed. Graphics of him were removed. He was an absolute, and that was a tough get too, because that was similar to, you know, your what we spoke of earlier with your blurring the WWF logo. You know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, and you would have to make notes of it. You would have to make notes. You know, in the notes they would say, you know, scratch logo. Massive cursing, Benoit, you know, that would have to be noted. It would have to be noted, you know, every time. And that was, I guess, more when we got to network, because then he was allowed, right? He was allowed, because we didn't want to lose any integrity of any shows. And I guess, you know, he did a lot of good wrestling, let's be honest, right? I mean, he did. So I think things changed. I think legally it changed. I think feelings changed. Again, we just follow direction. You know, I don't want to give you information that I don't have, because I don't know. You know, that's not fair. That was never something that, you know, I made any calls on. I just did what I was told. So others, if I could think for a moment, I know that there were certainly, like, down the line, there was like, I think one I can remember that came in the last 5 or so years, 10 years, whatever it might have been, was certainly was Buck Rock and Roll Zumoff. If you guys know the story about that dude, it's not a good one. So he did a lot of really bad things to a lot of really young women. So he was certainly then on the list.
He would have been in AWA.
Yep.
Somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah. And but the tricky part was he jobbed for us a lot.
Okay.
That nobody knew in the 90s on like Superstars.
Mm. Right. Because you have such this massive library and you never know
where the guy's like, going to show up. Right?
Especially if it's someone who you never thought of before.
Right. Like, right. And
if you're I remember seeing all that Buck Zumoff stuff here and there.
If you're not a wrestling guy, you know, if you're not a wrestling guy like, you know, we are, you wouldn't know who the hell Buck Rock and Roll Zumoff was, right? So that's, you know, that was a lot of our younger staff had to be taught that, you know. And I'm trying to think if there was others. I'm pretty sure there was definitely a handful, but I can't think of any off the top of my head. But if I do, I'll bring it up, late, you know, if we're still on the call here.
And if I'm looking at this Wikipedia page that's called W Libraries, and they say that within that is IWA Puerto Rico.
Yes, I forgot about that one. Yep.
And so that is something that W owns.
Absolutely. So that one was definitely there when I was there. I went through all of it because, again, one of my jobs was to comb through the stuff and make sure everything was legal to air, right? So I did a lot of that. It took the guys a long time to get, because there was a lot of it. And at that time, we were all tapeless at that point. So it takes the guys a long time to ingest large chunks of footage. It just takes a long time. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to air it. I want to say 2019, if not 2020, right before the pandemic. I think I was going to air it in some sort of it might have been late 2019. I wanted to air it in like Spanish Heritage Month, you know, like it's like a combo of September, October, or October, November, in that area. And I don't remember why. I think I don't know if it was maybe it was an approval thing, or we couldn't find enough full episodes that were good enough to air without so much problematic music that it would have taken us weeks to turn it around. I think that was what I remember. But yeah, I combed through a lot of it. That was a library that we definitely had on our radar for a long, long time, because so many guys wrestled for Carlos Colon. I mean, you know, who was the owner and promoter.
And this is listing 99 to 2001. Is that, do you know if that's accurate? Obviously, Puerto Rico existed long before and
That is inaccurate.
Okay.
That is inaccurate.
It looks like it's just listing the developmental.
Yeah, that's not accurate. That's not accurate.
Yeah.
It's the whole thing. It's all of it, because I saw footage from, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s.
Right.
Their music situation was dreadful. So, yeah, I know that was an issue. And it was harder because it was outdoors a lot, you know, so they aired a lot of this stuff from Roberto Clemente Stadium down there. So that was difficult to match the audio and the music and things of that nature. You know, to an outdoor crowd, to indoor crowd is a lot different. So, yeah, that's definitely a library that WWE does own. I did not have a part in that one. I don't remember why. I think it just kind of came up, and then I heard about it next. It was in the can. So I don't know why I didn't. But the answer is yes. It's definitely WWE owned.
And were there libraries that you tried to purchase that you weren't unable to, or the you just reviewed and the quality and content wasn't worth what they were asking for?
Absolutely. Yep, one that stands out to me is, do I know the name of it off the top of my head? That's the challenge. It was owned by Dick the Bruiser.
IWA in Indianapolis.
Sounds exactly. I was going to say IWA. I'm not lying.
He ran like an outlaw, promotion.
Yeah, it was like a lot of it. It was AWA spinoff, right? A lot of it was AWA guys. So Dick the Bruiser. We went to Indy. Same. It was always me and another colleague of mine. And it was good. It was okay. You know, it's just like some of the talent wasn't great. And I want to say the quality was decent. I don't remember it being poor. I know it was in a nice storage facility. So, you know, some of these things were not. So that was a major issue on some of them. But it was run by his wife, you know, because he had passed away. I think the asking price was too high for what we viewed the quality of the purchase was. I believe that was, I don't think there was enough AB talent there that was worth, you know, $1 million, if that's what he was asking. And I just made that up. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I know that it was, I believe that was the conclusion. It was not worth the price. I mean, we certainly spent a few days down there and certainly combed through a lot of it. But I think that was it. And like I said, I don't recall it being a quality issue. But like, for instance, you know, to that point, like, you know, the Von Erichs, you know, the library on one hand, the tapes, the regular show, you know, and we got multiple shows from him. You know, there was another thing called Texas Wrestling, which was prior to WCCW. So some of those episodes are around. I don't think there was a full library to air. And then there was another one that was No, I'm sorry. So the Texas wrestling was way, way back. That was like in the more of the Fritz era, you know, so 50s and 60s, and that was all film. And there's definitely been clips of that of air here and there. But those, again, those are difficult to put together because they're only like one or two matches. It's never like a full show. And those were awesome and great quality. And they were just the tapes themselves, right, for the regular world-class show were stored wonderfully. They're in a storage facility, you know, cooling, you know, the right temperature. The the film footage and a lot of this Texas wrestling stuff was and Kevin is a good friend, Kevin Von Erich. He stored them on the Von Erich Ranch in a barn in the backyard. So you imagine how some of the quality of those tapes were, those film reels were. You know what happened to some of those film reels when they opened them? They turned into soot, is what happened. So, you know, we lost a lot of those, you know, which was unfortunate, you know, because they just weren't stored properly. I mean,
and that was older footage?
Yeah, film canisters. That
like before
just,
the 80s footage?
Like I'm talking about when we got them back there, we had guys in hazmat suits opening them up because they the smell was so raunchy. It just was hard to even be around them because, you know, they were stored in a 150-degree barn for 20 years, you know, whatever long it was, you know. So those sometimes those things didn't work out. Thankfully, we were able to save some of them. You know, like I said, there's probably at least 30 or 40 of those reels that are good. And that's just it's a guess. There was a couple others that we never went to see and review. I don't think it got to a point where it was non-negotiable anymore, just because I think obviously there was a pricing issue. And I think that happened with the Paul Bosch group down in Houston.
Mm-hmm. Which that's like a famous missing. That's yeah. A famous missing.
Billy Corgan now owns those rights, I believe.
I mean, they had it.
Missing is not the right word, but a famously.
It was negotiated with for quite a while. I had a buddy that was involved in it, you know, and I think they just couldn't come to the right asking price, so they never sent us out there. That's what I believe. And some of it came over with Watts. So we do. I'm sorry with the Wii stuff. I'm just so used to work there a long time. The WWE has some Houston wrestling because it came Watts and he had an agreement. And again, somehow this part of this agreement was actually legal. I don't know how it was, but it was. So because they did a lot of swapping and they did a lot of Watts did a lot of shows in Houston with Bosch, with like a co-promotion kind of thing. So there is some of that does exist in WWE. And then like we did some stuff with Portland, I think. We definitely did a negotiation for the Piper DVD, you know, because that's where Roddy started. And we got rights to the Roddy footage from Portland. And then I think there was a deal on the table and somehow it got scrapped. I don't remember what happened to that. And then there was certainly talk over the years with the Labels, you know, without in L.A., because that was a lot of good stuff with you know, Pat Patterson and Ray Stevens and, you know, a lot of the type of stuff happened out there in San Francisco and L.A. and that kind of thing. And I don't know why that never happened. You know, I think there was a pricing issue, but this is just me speculating. And then there was a lot of other ones that were on the list. Like there was a master list at one point with all the libraries that were out there. Some of them I didn't really even know about. So certainly, you know, there was certainly some more up in Canada, you know, that were talked about from time to time with like the Rougeaus and.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Grand Prix. I feel like I remember WWE purchasing Grand Prix.
Well, Grand Prix was on the radar for a lot of years. And again, I don't know. I don't have the answer. I don't know why it would have been nice. It would have added us, you know, something, another, you know, territory to deal with, which is all.
Because that would have a lot of A level content. Like you'd have a ton of Andre stuff.
Yeah. Well, without a question, you know, and I don't know what the answer is. I know it was talked about probably for a decade and then nothing happened. I don't know. You know, like I said, that was kind of out of my realm. I didn't have anything to do with it. I just had to do was the guy that went there and made sure it was good.
And I want to ask you about one of the tape libraries that I hear, you know, territorial wrestling fans talk about a lot is sort of the revolutionary era of TV wrestling, and I think it's pretty fragmented as far as the ownership goes, but and that's the Memphis tape library, particularly throughout the 80s.
Yep, 100%. Unfortunately, you know, we did get there was a separate, I forgot about this too, there was a separate purchase of USWA, not the Lawler version, the Jerry Jarrett version. So WWE owns that.
Is that global? Is that what people mean when they say global?
Global is part of that too, yes. There was a couple different shows. Global was one, and then like just the USWA Excitement or something. I forget what the name of the show was, but there was that. Because we've aired those before. Those definitely have seen the light of day. Yeah. Because Booker T, you know, those guys came from there. You know, Booker T and Stevie, right? That's where they started. So we've used that before for those guys. Before they were Harlem Heat. So that does exist. And that was basically what that was, is that is when Fritz went out of business, Jarrett took over the territory basically and made it USWA. They had a match at the end that was like World Class versus USWA. You know, that was like the last World Class match that ever happened.
Clash.
The last match that ever happened, right? And they had I should remember this too. The USWA prevailed, right? So they became USWA. They were wrestling right out of the Sportatorium in Dallas, like World Class was, but it was a different organization. But the Memphis was always talked about. And the fact that, you know, a lot of it was owned by Jerry the King Lawler, and he was, you know, a loyal employee of WWE for 100 years now, that we couldn't make that negotiation happen always blew my mind. I could never figure it out. You know, he certainly let us use it from time to time, but the full purchase just never came to fruition. He was always weird about it.
Does he own it? Or because the impression I have is that the Memphis promotion went through various different entities, yeah, and different owners over time. So I think it's
you are absolutely correct. So what happened was, I think that was a big stick in the negotiation because
owns it.
Yeah, exactly. So he would say, "Oh yeah, all this is mine," and then upon further review, it was like three different guys. You know, it wasn't all his at all. You know, so thank you for jogging my memory. That's exactly what it was. It was owned by several. I think Jarrett was still one of them, but there was certainly a couple other guys that were involved over the years. That's why we could never make that happen, because there were so many different moving parts that it was just not doable. And you know, half the time, like I said, the King was, you know, given on the up and up, and half the time he wasn't. So that was hard to figure that out.
Yeah. And I want, it comes to mind, like when in March, Tony Khan acquired Ring of Honor.
Yep.
Are you aware of like any negotiations or pursuit that WWE had of the Ring of Honor library or any kind of licensing of their tapes?
I got to imagine that was on the table, but that again, I can't speak to it because it was after me. Okay. So I don't know. Like, I don't remember that ever being a thing like when I was there, because they were up and fully active at that point. You know, they were doing their own thing. They were pretty damn successful at that point. So like that was, I guess it was always talk that, why wouldn't that be great if we get in some deal with Ring of Honor? Like, anybody would want to do that, because we had most of the guys on the roster. So yeah, I would imagine so, but I don't remember that being like, oh, we're getting close, we're going to make a deal. You know, like that never was a thing as far as I knew.
You've touched on this a lot throughout the podcast, kind of talking about what it was like working for WWE. How would you describe the work environment of WWE as an employee there for a long period of time, if it changed over time, or if it was always kind of the same kind of the way you describe it is kind of like inconsistent, out of control. There is this, the goals, then the goals move, and then you change what your operations are going to be and what you're supposed to be focusing on. There's new directives. How would you describe the overall nature of working at WWE?
I mean, you know, look, every company has certain quirks and ups and downs and things of that nature. It's just part of be in a billion-dollar organization, I would imagine. You just kind of it's hard to say. You know, you just it was, you know, sure, at times it was frustrating. Sure, at times it was difficult. But, you know, you went there and you did your job, you know, and you did your job to the best of your ability. And, you know, if directive changed, you know, if you put in a lot of work and it was, you know, ended up going in a different direction. Hey, listen, you know, that's kind of the way it was, you know, a way it is, I guess. I mean, you just had to adapt and you had to roll with the punches. But at the end of the day, you had to do your job to the best of your, you know, like I said, to the best of your ability. And, you know, put the other, you know, nonsense aside and just work hard. You know, you had to deal. Yeah, it was certainly a lot of ups and downs and certainly a lot of all over the place kind of stuff. I mean, anybody who tells you that that's not the case is not telling the truth. So, certainly, I think that's an accurate painting.
Did you work with like closely with Vince at all? I know that you probably maybe when you were with, you know, more the television commentary side of things, did you work with him? Like,
no, rarely. I mean, okay. He certainly would, I guess say hello from time to time, but like I had very little interaction with Vince.
Mm-hmm. So who would you say is like, was over your time, especially when you're working with the network and things like that, were you overseeing, who was you like your direct supervisor?
Why is that relevant?
Oh, no, I'm just curious.
I if you don't mind, I'd rather not name anything.
No, it's totally up to you.
I would love to, but I think it's probably my best interest to not do that.
Understood. What do you think about WWE's content? Now it seems like they have more of a cable presence now, where some of this work that maybe you would have used to see on the network and maybe projects that you worked on for the network are now getting deals like the A&E biography series, right. And they're doing kind of the post talk show kind of aspects of it. What do you make about that? Like kind of, you see the kind of their content is spreading beyond just the network and beyond just what might be this niche interest into presumably lucrative cable deals.
Look, I think it's great for the product. I mean, it's great for the company, I guess. You know, I mean, I understand that, you know, there's a lot of similar to what we talked about earlier. I think there's a lot of more deep standard of practice folks over there as well, you know, cause that's what I've heard. You know, I know the shows have been very difficult and a lot of times come back with, like I mentioned with the Fox folks, you know, with X amount of changes that you just didn't see coming. And I know it's been a long process, and I know it's been a lot of hours from, you know, what I heard, what I know. Look, it's wonderful. You know, I'm a wrestling guy, like I told you, you know, to see the product get spread about, you know, other, you know, viable networks is cool. You know, yeah, it's great. I love the biography idea. Even though it's a weird off the track, you know, not WWE thing, just like even those Dark Side of the Rings, you know, that's interesting, cool stuff. That's, you know, wrestling relevant, I guess, you know, so it's really nice. I mean, I love to see it get out there and, you know, I think, you know, AEW is doing a bang up job too. So, you know, it's all good. I'm just waiting for them to have some kind of a streaming situation and, you know, I'd love to, you know, I've already pitched myself out there to be involved in that if that ever happens. So, it's great.
Need someone to scrub ROH tapes, and I'm sure there's a lot of ROH stuff.
I would imagine there is.
That ROH library has a lot to.
I would imagine because I can't, especially, you know, from years past, obviously. So, yeah, I'm fascinated that it's still, you know, that they're doing stuff now, you know, that especially now with like Warner Brothers Discovery on board. That they're not having them clean that stuff up, you know, as far as the blood, and, you know, like blood and guts the other last week or whenever that was, you know, that was, you know, that's pretty, you know, that was not 2020 wrestling, you know, anymore, but there are folks who think that's what it's supposed to be. So, you know, that's okay too. I'm just surprised by it. That's all.
I'll say this about Discovery Warner, their biggest annual thing outside of the NBA playoffs is a block of programming that is all about sharks.
True.
And I was watching, someone showed a listing of a show tonight where it's like, I think it's called Sharks versus Pigs. And the theme is that sharks will be essentially eating pigs that are trying to swim away from them.
Tremendous.
So I always, it's kind of funny when it's like, oh, I don't know if Warner is going to be on board with all this blood and guts. I'm like, have you seen some of the stuff that the other show?
It's a good point. It's a good point.
It's kind of funny.
But
wrestling's unique in how its violence is portrayed.
But I guess that's what I heard, right? And I'm sure you guys heard this. It was that's why they're doing that shark cage gimmick in the next AEW.
It's tie-in, yeah.
It's sponsored the tie-in. By Shark Week.
Yes, sir. I love. Oh my God! Can we move on?
So I wanted to just kind of ask to wrap things up here on like just your general reflections on the network. I mean, it's a really interesting legacy as far as one of the first kind of OTT services of its kind, and then kind of how its legacy shifted from to the point where it's no longer available in the United States, at least, and it's kind of been enveloped by this Peacock thing. But what overall, like, what are your kind of thoughts and reflections on having worked, you know, on the network for pretty much its entire existence, and especially those years where it was rumored about and it was supposed to be a cable channel, I believe, was the original thought behind it. Just kind of what are your general thoughts on the WWE Network as a concept, as an experiment, as a way for the way to present the product and these video libraries? What are your general thoughts on that?
We were running, we were actually running promos on our classics shows, promoting the network in 2012, and then having to pull them down and pull it off when they said, yeah, that's not happening anymore. You know, so we got bitten by that as well. In general, I mean, I love it. I mean, I feel like that's a big chunk of my life is there, you know, and we worked very hard to get all those shows up and to clean up all those shows and make them relevant and presentable and enjoyable. And, you know, look, the concept is great. I mean, it changed from time to time. Like I said, the back and forth with the linear stuff was kind of, you know, a tough bump. And then, you know, to have VOD as your star and then not as your star, you know, obviously, again, was not my favorite thing that happened. But I guess it just kind of evolved, you know, it evolved into, you know, more original programming than not, you know, and that's kind of what people, you know, that are making the decisions, I guess, are on board with these days. So that's kind of where it's at. I think it's not available in the United States unless you have Peacock. I think that's unfortunate for some folks because, you know, some folks can't get it or some folks aren't willing to do it. You know, I would have rather it just stayed. But, I mean, again, it's a lucrative deal for the company and, you know, they're going to do that every 10 times out of 10, you know, and they would be foolish not to, I suppose. I guess, you know, if you wanted them to think more about the everyday fan, I guess you could make that argument, but you know, it is still corporate and it is going to be run by corporate folks and do best for the bottom line. I mean, any company is going to do that. So, I think overall it's been successful. It's certainly had ups and downs, no doubt. But I like certainly what we were able to accomplish, you know, when we were kind of running that whole situation and I'm proud of it. And I hope that it just, you know, certainly gave some people some joy and some memories and just, you know, had some fun with it. And, you know, hopefully it continues to, you know, evolve down the road. And, you know, I sure as heck wish I still had a hand in it, to be honest.
I mean, definitely, I think as a regular, from the fan perspective, it's, I think it's now it's taken for granted because all of our content is like this, but there's just the absolute difference in going from having to tape trade, having to download torrents if you could find them, having to hope that they had certain things at the video store or buying DVDs. You know, I used to go to Newberry Comics and buy DVDs because they had the rented, the used ones.
It's amazing and wonderful
such a difference
to have a part in that and to be and I would argue a major part in that. And I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I'm just trying to be honest. I'm thrilled and I'm proud and just to have all of that at your fingertips is amazing in this day and age. And, you know, if we only had that, you know, when I was a kid, you know, you would have to search and search and search. Like we actually, I grew up in Boston, and we ended up actually getting world class on like the first syndicated deal that they ever made. And like, that was a, like, but you had to figure out where it was on the old dial and, you know, whatever. We didn't even have VCRs back then, you know, I'm old. So it was, to have all of this stuff at your fingertips and just, you know, for me to be able to go through all that world-class stuff that I remember as a kid and be able to produce it and give it to other folks and to like become friends with Kevin Von Erich, who like I idolized when I was a kid, you know, it's crazy good. And, you know, Michael, I mean, P.S., I've known my whole life. My whole career. I've known him since I walked in the door at WWE. So, you know, that stuff is unique and it's cool. And to be able to present that out there, you know, with thousands of hours and be responsible for a majority of it and you know, to give that to the audience, to the WWE Universe and others is super cool. So.
I was going to say, only in professional wrestling can you say, I'm getting on a plane to talk to the widow of a man named Dick the Bruiser.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's a very important business deal working on with the widow of Dick, the late Dick the Bruiser.
We have the late Dick the Bruiser's wife who has some tapes she's sitting on that are going to cost us $1 million, but we'll get back to you.
All right. Well, thanks so much for participating in this. I think this is a really interesting conversation. Happy for Brandon to help put it together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it very much. And Brandon, like I told you in the past, please do not hesitate. You know where I am.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks for being so generous with your time. I think people who are big fans of all varieties of regional wrestling from back in the day and who grew up as tape traders like I did, hopefully they'll really appreciate this and appreciate the work that you've done as well to help us see all this stuff. So thanks again, John.
I hope so. And I thank you guys very, very much. And I'll look forward to it. Hopefully I'll get a look at the finished product sometime.
Cool. All right. Thanks again, John.
All right. Very good, guys. Take it easy.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.